Good morning, John.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
We are great. We really appreciate you joining us today. Today is National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. Before we talk about your background, what does today mean for you?
I think for me and the Indigenous people across the country, it's just nice to be able to keep it in the conversation. I think so many times and events have happened over the past 100+ years that it gets talked about short term, and then it just gets pushed back until whenever. And now, with the unfortunate unearthing of the grave sites, and with the pandemic coming around, and Truth and Reconciliation, and having Mary Simon as our Governor General, all these things are snowballing to keep our issues and our move forward in the conversation. And I think that's what we want: conversation, questions, research. Those are the things that's going to help push us forward. And I think for me, that's the biggest thing, is the ability to talk about it without, at times when I was younger, it was like you were talking to people who didn't get it. And I get why, but now a lot of people do and understand and have done the research. And I think this has given us hope to be able to move forward and eventually feel that we're taken seriously, and we're actually an integral part of this country as it moves forward.
And to that, John, is the real positive of having a day is now a discussion, and hopefully changes happen or have happened, versus waiting for something bad to happen,
yeah,
and then it's on the national scale?
Exactly. And I think, you know, the Orange Jersey Society, the Orange T-shirt Society, these things have sprung out of the graves, and it's always that way, unfortunately, where something so unfortunate has to happen where it just jars people to their core to have things move forward. But these things have gained traction, and we've kept that in the public's conscience. And I think it's not a guilt thing anymore. We don't have to guilt people into responding and understanding. There is an understanding. There is something to what we've been saying as a people all along, and that people are reaching out and trying to find out more and trying to understand the actual history of our country. And I think that helps move the needle and helps it push forward and help level the field that we're trying to reach as Indigenous people.
Talking to former NHLer John Chabot, 500 games in the National Hockey League, now doing some great work in First Nations communities today. Can you take us through what life was like for John Chabot growing up?
Well, you know, it was a different era. And I look at what's going on now, and I look on things that are coming up that happened 20 and 30 years ago, and through my hockey career, whether it be as a kid and the crap I had to deal with. And it goes back to this conversation we started with, that people were so unaware of the situation of Indigenous people, that racism is and prejudice is based in ignorance for the most part. And the more informed you are, the more questions you ask, the more research you want to do, the more intelligent your questions are going to be and your comments are going to be. We're always going to have that minority that's going to, no matter what, is going to be racist. And unfortunately, that's not just towards Indigenous people. It's towards people who wear masks. It's towards Asians. It's towards African Canadians. I mean, that's just how it is, unfortunately. But my life as a kid was an Indigenous kid playing hockey with whites. And it still is a white man's sport, as most professional sports are, except for maybe a couple in the States. You know, hockey is primarily a white sport, and it's tough enough to play it at a high level as an Adam and a Pee-wee, without bringing parents' opinions into it, you know. And I think that my parents dealt with it a lot more than I had to deal with it as a kid. I used to wonder why my dad would sit apart from everybody, and as I got older, he explained to me why. And so, you know, it was hard on me in a different way, but it was much harder on my parents.
John,
go ahead.
No, as I say, when you do travel now, more importantly, at the Indigenous communities all around the country, what is life like in 2022?
It's gotten for a long time, it got better, like in leaps and bounds better. Education, social issues, dependency issues. But we've stagnated, and there's many, many, many reasons for that. One of them being, of course, residential schools and the ability to parent, which has been lost, the loss of culture, which is coming back. You go in the far north of Canada, where I spend majority of my time with First Assist, and it's different than being in the south of Canada, where, and I tell this to every time I go to a northern community, that I leave every time I leave with a sense of hope, because I see kids that are have smiles on their faces and show up and work hard and want to have fun, but they listen, and you know, school is becoming more of a priority, and the understanding that school is important has become a priority. And sometimes in the south, we've been beaten down so much that the step forwards are smaller and they're fewer, and there's more space between them, and you see the improvement, but some of the issues are just overpowering at times, and it takes strong leadership, which our youth are bringing back to our communities now after being educated at universities across the country and bringing that wisdom home. But we're still stuck, and we are moving forward, and the only way we're going to move forward, and it's like any movement in Canada, you need the one who's holding you down to work with you to bring you forward if you want it done quicker. And this is where we get our hope, is that a lot of the people in the non-Indigenous communities are now making an effort to help us move forward, which wasn't necessarily the case. And so I think that it will move forward quicker than it has over the last number of years because of the interest and the information research that's been going on there by non-Indigenous people.
Speaking with John Chabot, certainly the horror of the residential schools, John, as this has all, you know, come out in the last few years, it's mind-boggling for those of us, you know, who are not Indigenous. For a person like you, as you began to learn more and more about this, what were you left with? What are the thoughts that go through your mind when you just heard about the horrors of those places?
Shocking, but not surprising. We had known of it. My dad was a day school participant for a number of years. They tried to take him to residential school, and his mom would send him into the bush for 3 or 4 hours and hide, so they couldn't take him. But then he signed up to go to school in town. And once she did that, they kind of left him alone. But he did experience day school, and the experiences through residential schools has been a top of a conversation in our communities for years. And we knew what happened. We just weren't being listened to. And, you know, I go back to a story of a young lady in the West who would go to the RCMP and say, you know, my child never came home. Like, you have to find out where my child is. Now you're just making things up. You don't even know. And again, go home, you know, quit bugging us. Come back the next day and say, listen, my child isn't coming home. Where's my child? Got to the point where the officer said, listen, lady, if you come back here again, we're going to throw you in jail. And that's kind of the ignorance that we were dealing with. And it was hidden for a long time. And, you know, as a people, we knew. we knew what was going on. Just nobody would listen. And so when I say shocking but not surprising, that kind of defines that the numbers and what was happening were known by Indigenous people. And their elders had spoken of it. And our parents had spoken of it. So, you know, that it came out, and that you hope that, going back to our previous conversation, you feel that because of the atrocities that took place, that we are able to move forward now with the help. And if any good can come from something so horrible, that we can make sure that our youth have the opportunity to live a life that has not been available to them forever, that this is what the result is going to be.
And John, to that, what does the hockey mean for the kids? I can only imagine how long the winter is in the north, and activities and mental health and dealing with darkness. How excited are those kids when you show up with the equipment?
Oh, I mean, there's one reason why First Assist was formed, and that's it. I mean, I've been traveling north since I played in Montreal, which is 85, and I've been traveling to communities across the country, doing hockey schools, visiting, talking. And at one point in time, my son Kyle and I, we'd been traveling for 8 or 9 years, and we said, we've got to do more. This is just not, one-offs just don't work. Because we would go back to community maybe twice a year, maybe once every year, and we'd be welcome, kids would come up, and then we started going back a lot more often. And these kids were shocked that we were coming back that often. You know, they were so used to having people come in once and never show up again. And they would tell us, you're not coming back here. You know, no, nobody ever comes back. And so this is why we do this, is the ability to have a safe place, you know, to be able to congregate and just be, I think, is the most important part. Everything you feel about yourself, you feel good about yourself. Everybody who works out, you get that endorphin, you feel better, and you make better decisions. You look at life a little bit brighter. And you get to go to school, and your mind is perked, and you feel better about yourself, and it kind of gets the ball rolling in that direction. And you know, the ability to go up to north of Rankin and north of Yellowknife, and you know, work with Grand Chief Peter Johnson in the Yukon, and you know, those things are things that I'll never stop doing. I mean, I think as First Assist and as an Indigenous guy, I can't say it's my duty, but it's something that I feel very strongly about, and that it's, you know, the ability to bring a smile to a kid's face and to consistently see it there, and the recognition in their eyes when you come back, and the comfortable and trust that they have is something that, unless you've done it, it's almost indescribable.
Hmm. The kids that you see when you go to First Assist, they're no different than any other kids. They all have hopes and dreams, and I'll call you a bit of a trailblazer in terms of, you know, as an Indigenous person, of making the National Hockey League. And we still don't see a lot, but you know, Jordan Tutu, now we have Ethan Bear and Zach Whitecloud and a few other players. What does it mean to the kids when you go up and work with them, but then they can also see them on TV playing in the National Hockey League?
I think that's important. I mean, we have an NHL Indigenous alumni team that we travel with. We're heading to Elsie with Trache. We're also, finally, out of our stupidity, we've overcome, we're bringing the Indigenous members of our female national gold medal winning team, both world champions and Olympics, and Abby Rock from the American team is coming with us also. And I think it's important that, you know, they get to see the newly retired guys, and they get to see Brian Trache. They get to see, you know, Brandon Montour does stuff with First Assist and is a great kid. Bridget Laquette travels with us. Jocelyn LaRock. You know, we have Aaron Asham and Cody McCormick. So the chance for these kids to see ex-NHLers who have recently retired is almost more important than seeing the John Shabbats, because the parents know who I am, maybe. But the kids have no idea. They see a guy who can skate and shoot and is great and has a smile on his face and keeps talking, you know, but they don't necessarily get a chance to see, you know, me playing the game live. They get to see a tape. Oh yeah, you played in the NHL. But you know, so it's so important to see, like you said, to be able to see what they want to be. And, you know, the effect that it has on these kids when we go and they see that, and we talk about our journeys, and, you know, we don't only bring Indigenous guys, we bring white guys who have great stories. And we bring up Rick Natras, who was a single mom, had a single mom with four kids, and he would take the bus to practice and travel home at night and have the hitchhike. And these kids identify with stories like that, and it makes them feel like they're not alone, understand that there are issues that they deal with in their community, south and north. But there's not just Indigenous issues. There are issues that a lot of kids of our generation, some are, that we did, you know, we had to bunk with our friends or get a ride from our friends and get up at 5 a.m. to go to practice and freezing cold out. And we tell these stories, and there's a realization that there's an opportunity that if you want to work hard and not just in sport, but in whatever, that, you know, that you have a chance to succeed. And I think that is the everlasting story that we're going to leave. And that's what we try and do is, you know, life is there for you. And sometimes there's obstacles you have to overcome. Sometimes there's ignorance you have to overcome, but you persevere and work hard. You know, you can make yourself a pretty good life, and you can make it in your own community. You can make it outside your community. You can dictate what you want to do, and I think that is the message that we try and leave with them.
Yeah, listening is such a big part. I still remember rooming with Everett Santapass and going to high school with Chris Simon. So you certainly learn a lot from that, John. Yeah. To your point, though, on the female aspect, how important is it in Canada that we are one of the leading countries in understanding that there are opportunities for young females, whether it be education and certainly in any of the sports that they choose?
Oh, I think it's paramount. I mean, we had, when I was just starting first assist, we brought Kadisha Buchanan and Ashley Lawrence up to Whale Cove because they had played indoor soccer. So, let's bring up, and there was a lot of girls playing, so we brought them up, and it was like African-Canadian girls coming up to this northern community to play and teach soccer with, you know, with one of the teachers here from the back then it was the I can't remember the name of the soccer team, but they had one of their women came up with them and spent a couple of days there. It was just the ability to see that, you know, if you want it, you know, it's there for you, and you don't have to be from, you don't have to be a white, you don't have to be homogenized. You can fit in and be different, and this is what our girls, our Indigenous girls, give our program, is that they're damn good hockey players, and they have damn good stories, and they work damn hard. And you know, I listened to Jocelyn LaRocque's story about, you know, playing contact hockey at the age of 11 and 12, and parents over the glass screaming at their boys to run over that girl because she doesn't belong there, and her persevering and finally getting to play women's hockey and sitting in the dressing room with, you know, her heroes, Haley Wickenheiser and people like that, and you know, the pride that they have in what they did. And us as guys, you know, we deal with stuff, but, you know, what they dealt with is completely different. You know, she's 5'2" playing against 5'8" boys who are much bigger and having to worry about getting run over every day. And so their story is so important in moving sports forward, not just women's sports, but sports and understanding. And, you know, it's just to have them there, and it gives us more credibility as a charity. Also to have them involved, because we are trying to serve everybody. And when we go to these communities, it's not just Indigenous kids. We have, you know, kids from other countries who are living up there and working, who are involved in our program, who are white and non-white. And we want to make sure that we're a First Nation run, Indigenous run charity that tries to help. And we do serve Indigenous kids, but if you're there and you want to participate, you're more than welcome to join in. And these girls help promote that message that it's open to everybody.
Well, we're really happy that you were able to kind of share your story and all the great work that you've done for, well, I won't say for how long, John, because that would tell everybody how old you are, but for a very long time, and continue to do great work. And on this National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, we really appreciate you sharing your story and continue the great work that you're doing.
Well, thanks. And, you know, I've said this, and I'll say it again, that this is how it starts and ends, is with conversation, questions, and shows like yours, where it brings it out. It brings it out. And once it's out there and people talk about it, the process can continue. And this is what we need. And we had this conversation yesterday where it's not just like saying, well, I just keep asking questions. Well, why? Well, why? Well, why? Well, that's what you have to ask if you don't know. Then don't be afraid to ask. Don't be afraid to talk to an Indigenous person and ask them questions. We want to be heard. We want to be understood. And we want to be able to move forward. And sometimes it's not easy. But the question why is an important question. And we're always a sharing people, and we are very willing to share our history and our circumstances if it gives us the opportunity to heal and move forward.